This episode of the Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt, the number one GPS hunting app, and Final Rise, premium quality, made in USA hunting vests and field apparel, and Upland Gun Company, custom built and fit handcrafted Italian shotguns. Hey everyone, welcome to episode number 288 of the Birdshot Podcast. Thank you for joining us today. As always, we'll be talking hunting, fishing, and our connection to wild places with Tony Jones. In just a couple of minutes, I want to thank Patreon patrons of the Birdshot Podcast, those of you out there making contributions in support of the show to keep these conversations coming your way. I appreciate your support. Patrons are eligible for Patreon giveaways. We do some bonus content. We have some exclusive discounts. And we get everyone set up with the Birdshot Podcast can coolers and stickers. If you want to learn more and sign up, you can do so at patreon.com/birdshot. All right, a quick reminder for everyone. If you love the show and you want to help us out, you can always leave the show a rating, review, subscribe to the show, follow the show. Don't miss any new episodes. Make sure you are subscribed. All of those are helpful to me and the Birdshot Podcast as well. So I appreciate that. All right, hope you all are enjoying September so far. I'm sure a bunch of you have found some field time already. I have not, however, that should be changing in the next day or two. So I'm looking forward to that. And when you hear from me next week, I will be on the prairie chasing sharp-tailed grouse and Hungarian partridge if all goes according to plan. We've got some great shows coming up for you, including our annual interview with Ann Jandrena as the ruffed grouse seasons in the Great Lakes kick off this weekend. So stay tuned for that. Best of luck to you all on your upcoming hunts and keep on enjoying the best time of year. Today we are talking to Tony Jones, aka the Reverend Hunter and author of The God of Wild Places, Tony's latest book, one that we will discuss and reflect on in today's conversation. I had a great time catching up with Tony. He is a fellow Minnesota guy who I was aware of but had not yet had a chance to connect with him, cross paths, and we have plenty in common and plenty to discuss. I really appreciate Tony's perspective on hunting and the outdoors, which you will learn a little bit about how he came to it all. And if you read the book, you will gain a lot more insight into Tony's thoughts, perspective, and introspection, which I encourage you to read if you are interested in that sort of thing. Links to Tony's website and places you can pick up a copy of The God of Wild Places in the show notes. You know where to find it. With that said, let's welcome into the conversation and onto the Birdshot Podcast, Tony Jones.
Well, here we are on the Birdshot Podcast.
Yeah, I look behind you and see you got a dog looking out the window.
Oh, can you see that?
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, that's Rose. Yeah, we're gonna talk bird dogs today. That's my long-tailed pointing dog.
Okay.
Is yours nearby?
Yeah, he's my yellow lab. He's upstairs somewhere, and then I'm dog sitting a black lab that's owned by my niece while she's on her honeymoon. So yeah, we got a couple labs, and then my wife has a little rescue chihuahua mix something or other.
Yeah. Well, the dogs, they keep us busy, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, welcome to the show, Tony. It's as we were just chatting a minute ago, you and I have really never had the chance to connect, but we have many mutual contacts and friends. We're both Minnesota guys, and we're even both cake eaters in our own way. So it's great to have you on the show, buddy.
Oh, yeah. It's great to be here. And yeah, like I told you before we started recording, I have a great affinity for Duluth East because one of my first friends in college was a Greyhound, and we ended up I was the play-by-play guy, and he was the color commentator for men's hockey on the radio at our college.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's kind of a funny story that we walked in, like, during freshman orientation week to the college radio station. We were like, hey, we'd like to call some hockey games on the radio. And they're like, oh, you're, freshman, here, you come to some games, we'll give you a tape recorder, you can practice a little bit, and maybe by, you know, sophomore or junior year, we'll let you call some games on the radio. And really, this is how it went. And the guy's like, by the way, you know, where are you from? And I said, well, I'm from Edina, Minnesota. And Pete says, well, I'm from Duluth, Minnesota. And the guy goes, hey, can you guys go call the Princeton Army series next weekend? We'll give you all the gear and a truck. So we were thrown into the deep end of the pool as soon as we as we revealed where we came from. They're like, well, you know more about hockey than anybody who calls the games on the radio, so it's all yours. And then I did it for the next 4 years. It was a ton of fun. Yeah.
Did you really? That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, a couple of hockey towns. But I mean, we'll get a few eye rolls for this, but is there anything better than when Duluth East and the Edina Hornets meet in the state tournament?
No, that's pretty good. I mean, the Hornets keep rolling, man. I don't know, every 3-4 years they hang another banner from the rafters at Braemar Arena.
So you obviously didn't stick with the play-by-play announcing
When I was a senior in college, I actually sent my resume, you know, out to like ESPN, and this is in, you know, this is in the spring of 1990. Sent it out to ESPN, and I don't think Fox Sports even existed yet. I don't know who else. I sent it out to a few minor league hockey teams, and you know, never heard back from a single one, and ended up going to seminary. And you've read the book, so you know that the path my life took after that. But yeah, there are a couple alternative universes. In one, I'm a hockey play-by-play guy. In some other alternate universe somewhere, I'm a major league baseball umpire.
Love it. Yeah. I've got a few of those myself, I think. But I'm living this one.
Yeah. I mean, what are you going to do? Maybe I'll meet those alternate Tony Joneses somewhere. Down the road. Yeah.
So were you the play-by-play guy, not the color commentator?
And I was the play-by-play guy.
And big goal call.
I didn't. I mean, I don't think I. You know, he shoots, he scores. There's nobody. It's not like a home run call in hockey. You know, and of course Doc Emmerich was not yet on the scene, so it wasn't. Oh. People weren't trying to like compete with his incredible vocabulary. I thought I did a pretty good job. And the nice thing for me was when I did away games, I not only was the play-by-play guy on the radio, but I also was writing up. I wrote the stories for the college newspaper about the games. So on occasion, in a really boring game, I would make up a fight on the radio. I would just make it up, and I would start screaming, "There's blood on the ice! There's blood on the ice!" And then, you know, then I would kind of write that into the story in the paper that would appear, you know, the next day in the school newspaper about the fight. And it was always funny because there were never fights. I mean, this is ECAC hockey. So it's East Coast hockey. It's a little lighter than what people are probably used to when the Gophers play North Dakota or something, or UMD plays North Dakota, you know. Those are a little more rough and tumble type games. So I would, and the players always thought that was hilarious because the only people who knew that I wasn't telling the truth were the other people who were, you know, at some Sunday afternoon game at Brown or Yale. You know, nobody was, it was like kind of crickets in some of those arenas. So yeah, I had a lot of fun with it.
That's pretty funny. I've never gone down a deep rabbit hole thinking about the freedom and flexibility that a radio announcer might have, but there you have it.
These days you couldn't get away with it. You know, you couldn't probably get away with this kind of stuff we got away with now, but because everything's on, you know, everything's streamed, every game is televised. Yeah. In fact, sadly, my kid went to the same college, and they don't even, ESPN bought all the rights for broadcasting every single sport at that college. So there's no more student radio station. There's no more student broadcasting. Yeah, it's kind of a tragic deal, but times change. Yeah. What are you going to do?
Right. Yes, indeed. Well, man, I think I still have kind of the chills just thinking about the your near miss on Lake of the Woods, the opening chapter of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Man,
yeah, that
bring
story.
Me back to that. Was that your first? That was yeah. that your first hunt?
Yeah, man, that was my first ever hunt. I mean, I had been to the horse and hunt club with my uncle a couple times when I was in high yeah. school, you know, but you know, that's different. That's
yeah.
That's more like a video game than an actual hunt. And yeah, I got invited to go on this hunt, and I always knew even 10 or 12 years ago when I first came up with the idea for this book, that story was going to kind of be a cornerstone to the book, because it was it had such a huge effect on me. It changed me, you know, and it stuck with me. I mean, how many things do we do in our lives that we forget or are somewhere deep in the recesses of our memories that we can't even access or something like that? But there was this duck hunt with this guy. I was a pastor at the time, and he, after I, as I recount in the book, after I had this really inappropriate explosion of rage at a committee meeting at church, this guy Doug kind of took me under his wing, encouraged me to get into an anger management class, which I did, and invited me to go hunting with him. And he took me into the very north reaches of Lake of the Woods, which I knew nothing about. You know, I didn't grow up in an outdoors family. I wasn't one of these guys who grew up walleye fishing on Lake of the Woods. I mean, I knew Lake of the Woods existed, of course.
Sure.
But I'd never been there. I didn't know that it covers 1,679 square miles. I didn't know that it has 12,000 islands. You know, when you start to think of the immensity of Lake of the Woods, especially when you get up into the northern reaches of it, it's really it's a breathtaking body of water. And so he took me duck hunting there, and it was like really, it was a little bit like a you know, calling a hockey game with no experience in college on the radio. I got thrown into the deep end of the pool of duck hunting, and it was absolutely mesmerizing. You know, it changed my life. That experience of being in that lake with Doug duck hunting. And yeah, the story you're alluding to, it was on a ride home to his cabin in a duck boat. A storm had come in, fog had settled. He had no GPS. He just navigated this lake by memory, and we got lost in the middle of this storm. It was a very, very frightening night, because we were probably 2 or 3 hours from his cabin by duck boat, wow. You know, and we had no cell phone. I mean, this is 1999 or something. And well, we got out of it, but I just had this moment of peace and calm. I lived, as I recount in the book, I was in a very toxic marriage. I was a very angry person. I did not have peace in my life. Even though I was a pastor and I was preaching about peace, you know, on a regular basis, I was masking the truth, which was that I was not a peaceful person, not in a peaceful family situation. And I had this peace. I mean, it's almost biblical. Like, I found this peace in the middle of a storm, you know, and it stuck with me for many, many years. I didn't go back hunting for many years, but I always had this pull toward hunting because of that experience on that night.
Yeah. Yeah. It really was just, I think as we talked about at the beginning, you know, times have changed, and of course, yeah, now we've got our Onyx maps and our GPS, and I'm not much of a fisherman anymore, although I love to fish, and I've done a good bit of fishing in Ontario and lakes like that. I can only imagine what kind of electronics and stuff are in the fishing boats today, but to think that you're right out there navigating that kind of a lake, you know, covering that sort of distance in the dark, you know, on the, you know, in front of a storm and things are obviously going down. I mean, it was just, I think I, it was unsettling to even think about being in that situation.
Yeah, yeah, and it was just one of those, you know, there are several stories like that in the book where I wrote it and rewrote it and rewrote it and kept trying to get it just right. So I felt like the words on the page were an accurate representation of my experience that night. So, yeah, and I'm, you know, this 4 or 5 days from this recording, from you and me having this conversation, I'll be paddling into the Boundary Waters and with a group of guys. And I, to this day, don't, you know, I don't bring a GPS. I'm a map and compass guy. You paddle by guys with all the electronics and the forward facing sonar on their canoe, you know, and I'm just like, I don't know. That's just not the way I'm ever going to approach my time in the wilderness is with that kind of gear. And I'm not a guy who wears a GoPro on my hat on every hunt and trying to create content. I get that. I mean, I appreciate the guys who do it. I watch their videos. I find it interesting at like watching those, you know, watching their hunts during the off season on YouTube or something kind of keeps me fired up for yeah. hunting season. But yeah, I mean, I'm 56 and more as time goes on, I just feel like I'm just like a ink on paper guy. I still read the newspaper old school and yeah, so that's, I'm good with that.
I was thinking about newspapers the other, do you get one delivered to your house every day?
The Sunday, we get the Sunday. We don't Sunday. Do it. We used okay. to have it every day and we just were like, I would spend an hour and a half every morning reading the paper and I'm like, I need that time to write and garden and train my dog and do all the other stuff I want to do. So just the yeah. Sunday paper. And that's like a thing my wife and I do every Sunday. Yeah.
Yeah. I could get behind that. I don't know what set me off on this path, but something about newspapers. And I was thinking, and I mean, I'm 38 years old. So, I mean, I remember paper boys and deliveries and my dad was a paper yeah. boy when he was a yeah. kid a long, long time ago. But anyways, the point is it's crazy. I mean, finding sort of your relationship with technology in the outdoors, like we exist in this world where things have changed so dramatically and it hasn't taken that long. You know, I think about mentioning the Boundary Waters. My last couple of trips to the Boundary Waters were really this. I went back to back Labor Days with some college buddies. So, you know, this is a while ago, but at that time, we weren't mapping on our phones or looking at Google Maps or anything like that. It was paper maps. And that's really not that long ago. And right now you have, you know, again, the GoPro and, you know, I've experimented with all this stuff and trying to maintain this balance of, you know, is this intruding on my experience? Why am I here? You know, we're sort of all faced with those things. And everybody, of course, is going to come up with their own way to do it. But yeah, I appreciate that. How many trips to the Boundary Waters have you done this summer?
Oh, this will be my third. But I did a couple day trips. I did a day trip in with Joe Friedrichs of the Paddle and Portage. Those Paddle and Portage guys. I don't know if you follow them, but they're a great follow. Yet. They're out of Grand Marais, and they have got a great podcast. And then the other time I went in up by Ely to Basswood with my buddy Timo Rova, and we had, you know, that is like just a legendary fishing lake. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those deals where you can motorize boats in. You got to have portage wheels and roll your boat over the portages. I've never done that before, so that was a great experience and got to take my 19-year-old son with me. So those were day trips, and then this trip will go in at the end of the Gunflint Trail and do a big loop, go in on Big Sag and come out on Seagull about 5 days later.
Do they still do the little Jeep buggy portage where they'll tow your boat over to Basswood? Because I have done that before.
You know, I heard about that, but I don't know if they still do that because But we had these portage wheels, you know, that like ride mm-hmm. in the boat, and then you put them under the boat and you like push slash pull the boat over these yep. portages. So I'd never done that before. But then there's these other boats where the portage wheels are like built onto the back, and they kind of stick up out of the back. So I guess there's some guy in Ely, some welder who makes the, you know, you bring him your boat and he
sure.
attaches portage wheels to him. But the guys who do that, who do those basswood day trips, I mean, they have it locked in. You know what I mean? They know what time to leave the house, and they go and they've got the whole thing. They do it multiple times a year, and they go in there and they hammer walleye. Our fishing day wasn't the greatest, but still fantastic, you know?
Yeah. That's cool. Yeah. I mean, talk about, kind of epic lakes. I mean, that's one of them. I spent a little bit of time on there, not enough time to really do any damage on the fishing, but we've caught some. That's a big body of water.
Yeah, what are they're like, Tony, this is a meat factory, this lake. So, yeah, we had a lot of fun, but my kid is crazy about bass fishing. I mean, if it were up to him, all he would do is fish smallies on topwater lures all day. So the fact that he could just, I mean, those smallies were still hitting topwater lures at high noon, you know, and he's just like, I've never seen this before. Usually it's dawn and dusk. So just to see, to be out there and have a kid who my kid that of my three kids, he's the one who's really ravenous about the outdoors in the same way that I am. Just to see him with a grin from ear to ear because he's, you know, hammering bass, and then it's time to go because it's like a 2-hour commute back to Ely between the motoring back and then the portage
Are
and then
going
the loading
up
the boats
the chain
up
there, like the Sucker Lake chain, basically.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of the lake we put in at, but yeah,
I say it's like and, Moose something. And
yeah, two long. Like. There were two long portages that and you know these guys are telling me, oh, when I was a kid, my dad used to drive his Lincoln Continental up in here in the winter, and we'd drive over this portage and we'd drive across the lake and we'd ice fish. I'm like, oh my gosh. To experience it through him and the excitement. And then when it's time to go, he's like, no, I don't want to leave yet. we'll be back. We'll be back. So it was a lot of fun. And some people were like, you drove all the way to Ely so you could go one day and fish. And I'm like, no, you don't say no when you get invited on one of these. A guy has a day pass for a motorized boat into basswood. You're like, and he invites you and your kid. You say yes, and you just make it work, you know. So that's what we did.
You just go. Yeah, that's cool.
Do
you still do, and maybe this is what you're about, the guided trips where you're taking groups into the BWCA?
Yes, that's what I'm doing next week, and let's just not call it officially. I'm not officially a guide as far as the U.S. Forest Service is concerned. You know what I mean? I'm like taking in some buddies. There is a protocol for being a guide in the Boundary Waters that includes $1 million liability insurance, you know, policy, and so I'm not really doing it. That I'm not doing it for money but I lead trips of guys like, so this trip is interesting because it's a guy who's gone into the Boundary Waters with me several times before, and he's in a certain anonymous 12-step recovery fellowship, and he was like, I would love to do a trip just with guys who are in recovery, and we'd have like a 12-step meeting around the campfire every night. So that's what we're doing. So for the first time in memory, I will be going to the Boundary Waters without a flask of whiskey in my bag, out of respect for these guys who are in recovery, you know. But it should be a really fun trip.
Very cool. The reason I asked about that is because it was mentioned in the book that you would sort of lead groups in there. And I just kind of feel like, hey, it's one of these places, like I have an affinity for the Boundary Waters. I love it. I've been in it. I've been around it more, but I haven't been there in a long time. And it just kind of got the wheels turning in my head. Like, I wonder if there's like a groups or something, you know, I could just go tag along with somebody. And
Every summer. Yeah. No, I'd love to have you. First of all, it's crazy. You can like spit and hit the boundary waters from your out your window there. So
right, yeah,
that's shame on you, man. You got to get out there. But yeah, for sure. I mean, I would love to have you. I used to kind of advertise on my website, hey, I'm anybody want to go to the boundary waters with me? And I don't even really do that anymore because I have so many people just reaching out to me and saying, hey, can I put together a group and will you kind of take us in? Because, yeah, it can be intimidating for people who haven't done it before. Yeah, I'd love to go in there with you anytime. And, dude, you know what you should do is go up in there and grouse hunt.
Yes. Yeah. That's been suggested many, many times. I absolutely get behind the idea. I almost did it one time, with some, actually the guys from the Flush were going up there. I don't know that they actually ended up going in there. They went with a friend of mine, but anyways, yeah, I mean, that would be very, I've as I'm sitting in my house in the depths of winter dreaming about like, oh, looking at the wildfires, you know, where have the wildfires been, you know, 10 years ago and to go up there and to hit some of those covers. And yeah, but then inevitably I get thinking about logistics of dogs and all of the things, you know, and then I just go hunt.
No, you're right. There's more logistics for sure than just putting your dog in your truck and driving out to some public land and walking logging roads for grouse. For sure. And I'm fortunate that my dog, I mean, look, I, as I write in the book, you know, I run labs because I love to duck hunt and I do a lot of pheasant hunting in really thick cover in South Dakota. So I just love labs. I just think they're just a great all around dog. I've never had pointers. I hunt with a lot of other guys who have pointers, but I'm a lab guy. So they're not ideal for grouse. I get that. And it's, with any breed of dog, right, it's a give and take. Like you're gonna have some types of hunting that are your dog is just perfect for, and other parts that are really a challenge. And grouse hunting is a challenge with a flushing dog, but he's a great canoe. Like my dog is a great canoe dog. He's very calm in the canoe and very steady. So that makes it a little bit easier to do something like that. And yeah, there's certain places. I mean, I remember last year we were at a campsite on Alpine Lake, and every time somebody went to sit on the biffy, there was a rough grouse sitting on a branch like 10 yards away, just watching you as you did your as you did your business on the biffy. There's a grouse sitting there, and that, like you say, I mean, that's a place where they'd had a blowdown followed by a fire like 10, 15 years ago. So it's just ideal grouse habitat full of, you know, a 10-year-old aspen stand, and it's pretty sweet.
Yeah. No, that's cool. To your point, there are bigger reasons to go grouse hunting up there than, you know, getting bogged down with logistics. That's not the same as me just going out for an afternoon hunt around here. So I could definitely get behind it. Actually, it's funny you mentioned that. The last time I was in the boundary waters, I don't even remember where we were, but we were camping on an island that was a decent size island. Like it would probably take you, I don't know, if there was a trail, like you could probably walk around it in 15 minutes. It wasn't very big, but it was an island, and there were grouse on that island. And I just remember going down this, like thinking of like, yeah, did they fly out here in the winter? Like, how did they end up here?
Right. I mean, that's the question for me
too. It wasn't that big of an island. Yeah.
Right. Do they fly between islands, or is this like this grouse spends its entire life on this island and it eats and it breeds and it dies on this island? Yeah, that would be a fascinating conversation to have with a wildlife biologist.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. Circling back a little bit to kind of some of the origins in the book, there was a unique piece of family history in. How do you say, is it Machno?
Machno, yeah, Machno.
Machno Jones. Okay, so that's your great-great-grandfather or something?
Great-great-grandfather, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. The bit about him having an encounter with Frank and Jesse James.
Jesse James.
How did you, is that like family history? Like, how did you uncover that? How did you research that?
Yeah, that's a good question. It wasn't even a story I knew. It wasn't a story my dad or my grandfather told. But I was doing some research and I reached out to some distant relatives by email. And, you know, it's funny. I think I tweeted back before Twitter was a dumpster fire of a website, when it was actually a helpful website. I think I tweeted something like a thread about Machno, because I had been doing some family research or whatever. And it's a unique name, you know, so it came across to some of my relatives, very, very distant relatives, including one in Wales and somebody else in northern Minnesota and somebody else somewhere else in the world, who reached out to me all individually. And I kind of put these three guys in like a group email for the four of us and started writing, well, here's what I found out about this ancestor of mine. And we shared this ancestor, you know, and so other guys were like, oh, this is what my aunt told me. And then I found this old book that's like called The Welsh in Minnesota. And it was published in, I don't know, 18 or something. And there's a entry in there about my great, great grandfather. And then, yeah, I came across it was written down by another relative, this story that he was a preacher and he was on his way to church one day walking. He had like a quarter mile walk from his homestead to where the church building was. And these two rough looking dudes come up to him on horseback and ask him to preach a sermon to them. They say, are you a preacher? Yeah. Will you preach us a sermon? So he stands there on the ground in the middle of a farm field in, you know, Blue Township in southwestern Minnesota and preaches a sermon to these guys on horseback. He finishes his little sermon to them. They offer him money. He refuses. And, you know, off they gallop on their horses. And he realizes later, maybe when he reads the Mankato newspaper, you know, on Monday or something, that's Frank and Jesse James, who had their botched robbery attempt in Northfield, Minnesota on Thursday. So it's 3 days later and they're heading west. You know, they're the only two guys who got away from the big Northfield bank robbery of the James Younger gang. Everybody else was captured or killed. They got away. And, you know, according to my great-great-grandfather, preached him a little sermon on horseback Sunday morning on his way to church.
That is wild.
Yeah, it's kind of a fun story. And wouldn't have known it had I not been researching this for the book. And, you know, the whole reason I put that section about my great-great-grandfather in the book is because when I decided to become a clergyman, my dad was so proud because he'd had this very patriarchal figure in his family who'd been a Welsh Presbyterian minister in southern Minnesota. So he was like, oh, you know, he'd always tell me, oh, your Grandpa Machno, he was also a clergyman.
I don't know that I was aware that is that bank robbery? That's like a key part of the younger James story. Like, would that have been in the movie? Like the assassination of Jesse James? Like, I didn't know that it was in Northfield, Minnesota, I guess.
Yeah, very famous. Every year in Northfield, they reenact it on the day of when it happened.
Wow.
Yeah, they still to this day, and they, you know, they've got actors, people who live in Northfield do it every year, and, you know, they come out of the bank, guns blazing, and really, I mean, the story of it is that Frank and Jesse James and the younger guys, this band of outlaws who were bank robbers, they rolled into Northfield, Minnesota, basically thinking that all these Scandinavian blockheads would just roll over. You know, they thought, oh, this is going to be one of the easiest bank robberies we'll ever have, because these guys are just a bunch of Norwegian and Swedish farmers in this little town in southern Minnesota. This will be no problem for us to knock over this bank. And the citizens of Northfield fought back. I mean, and the James Younger gang was caught completely off guard And yeah, that kind of ended their crime spree because it was their last big robbery attempt and it went sideways and those two guys got away, but nobody else did. And the people of Northfield became like heroes around the country.
Yeah, kind of a bit of
because
a pride
they'd,
for them.
They'd be, they'd been the first, they'd finally, the James Younger gang had been stopped from robbing a bank.
Unbelievable. I'm kind of surprised that bit of Minnesota history has sort of evaded me.
Well, I mean, you're
went in one ear and out the other.
If you grew up in southern Minnesota, maybe you would have learned that. But you're up north. You guys probably don't spend a lot of time thinking about us down in the cities and farther south than that.
Yeah, yeah, the 6-1 tours, right?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
So you go on the duck hunt to Lake of the Woods, and then you go away from hunting. And how do you eventually find your way back? I'm sure it's detailed in the book, but I'm curious what sort of brought you back to hunting, and then when did the bird dogs enter your life?
Yeah, well, I probably went on that duck hunt when I was about 30. I was a youth pastor,
yep.
And I think all I can say now is I think it planted a seed in me, a taste for it, you know. But my life took a different path. It included, like, I left being a pastor in 2003, went to Princeton to get a PhD in theology, took my family with me, hoping that kind of getting some distance from our families and stuff and from me being a pastor would maybe help my marriage out. It didn't help my marriage. So by 10 years after that dunk hunt in, 2003, in 2008, let's see, sorry, that duck hunt was in, like I said, what, 99? So yeah, 10 years later, 2008, 2009, I was filing for divorce. Very, very contentious divorce. And then followed a few years after that with a big custody fight. And those two events, the divorce and then the custody thing, really tore my life apart. All the things you hear, worst divorce ever. Two different judges actually in Hennepin County looked down from the bench and said, "This is, I think, the worst divorce I've ever seen." And these were not inexperienced judges. It was ugly. It was super ugly, and it also spilled out onto the internet, which pretty much destroyed my career as a pastor and kind of a semi-celebrity preacher and theologian and Christian author. So I got, foreclosed on. I lost my house. I barely saw my kids for a while till I ended up getting custody of them. I got full custody of my kids ultimately, but for a stretch there, it was super lonely, and that's when I started hunting again. I had this seed planted in going up to Lake of the Woods a couple times with Doug and duck hunting, and he had taken me once out to South Dakota to pheasant hunt. And I had a dog in that marriage who I write about my, and I just even heard on your last episode, you talked about this kind of how you like measure your adult life by your different
yes.
gun dogs that you have, which I think is a pretty common deal. And there's a great Jim Harrison quote at the very end of the acknowledgments in my book that is where Jim Harrison like wrote that exact thing. Like you basically measure, it's like he left a lot of books behind, but his life was measured by the gun dog, by the hunting dogs who'd lived and died with him. Those are the chapters of my life. And that first dog was not a hunting dog. I mean, maybe he went to the horse and hunt a couple times, but he kind of learned to hunt toward the end of his life a little bit. But then during probably the lowest time, I'd started dating Courtney, who's my wife now. She lived in Texas, and she, I'd heard about a dog at a breeder in Menominee, Wisconsin, a family friend. And this dog, Albert, had been returned. It was a one-year-old lab who'd been returned to the breeder, you know. And he was looking to get rid of the dog. And I think it was I think Albert was $425. And I'm not kidding. Like, I'm at the time, I don't know, 40 years old. I do not have $425 for a dog. And then there was a check in the mail from Courtney, who lived in Texas, and we just been dating long distance a little bit, for $425. And I drove to Menominee and I bought that dog. And then Albert became my hunting companion for the next 10 years as I kind of rebuilt my life. And not only rebuilt my life, like ultimately got custody of my kids, bought a house, got, you know, professionally kind of stable again, got remarried, got married to Courtney, and rebuilt my life that way. But also this passion for hunting was really planted during those 10 years because it was just one of the things that I could do that got me away from all the drama of my personal life, all the drama of like court dates and child custody evaluations and meeting with guardians ad litem and taking my kids to therapy and having school conferences with their teacher, all the stuff that I had to constantly deal with at home. When I went out hunting with Albert, the dog, my yellow lab, all that stuff faded away. You know what I mean? And I found that whether I was duck hunting or pheasant hunting or grouse hunting, it demanded my full concentration, and I was pulled away from all the drama. I could just focus for a few hours just on me and the dog and being in the wilderness. And man, I mean, I'm sure you can relate to this. I'm sure almost all your listeners can relate to this. That was just like, it was so healing for me to be out there. And it was exactly what I needed. And frankly, as I write about in the book, it healed me and healed my soul in ways that the church didn't. And I'm not disparaging the church or people who go to church, but for me, as somebody who'd been like kind of a celebrity pastor, I was not well cared for by the church, and hunting became my like spiritual pursuit.
Yeah. Hence the God of Wild Places, the book.
Right, exactly. Yes.
Yeah. 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 But no, I'm telling you, I mean, I appreciate that. I did look up I grabbed the book here and I got to read it because it is really good. And
yeah, read it.
I was reviewing your book this morning, actually, I think I came across that passage again where you were describing how you kind of measure, you know, your life is chapters of the different dogs you have. And I immediately thought of George, the interview that went up this morning. And, but yeah, the quote from Jim Harrison, he leaves a trail of books, but he really marks the passage of time by the series of hunting dogs he's left behind. It's literally the last like words of text in your book, in the acknowledgments section. So very fitting.
Thrilled to let Jim Harrison have the last word in my book.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But again, you obviously have a unique perspective in someone that you were in the church, you were a part of the church, you went through these things, and you've now sort of found your peace and other things in the outdoors. And anyone that reads the book, The God of Wild Places, will pick up on that. And to say it was thought-provoking would be an understatement. I mean, as I read through the book, I have a young family, a wife, two kids, and just it was a reminder of like how you build this thing up, right? This life, and you do these things and you make these choices, and how fragile it all could be, and these types of things happen to anybody. There were many parts in the book that kind of stopped me in my tracks and just had to sit there and think. I mean, that was probably what I did the most as I was reading through it.
That's super gratifying to hear. I mean, even this summer, even though I'm not actively a pastor anymore, of course, because I'm like the ordained clergyman of the family, I get called on to do certain duties. And this summer
I officiated the funeral for my 41-year-old cousin who died of cancer and left behind an 8-year-old and a 6-year-old. And then a month later, I performed the wedding of my niece and her husband now, and they're 26, 27. Yeah, man, you just, I'm performing their wedding, you know, and everything to them, they look and they see just like a straight road ahead of them, you know, with no twists, no bumps in the road, nothing. It's like,
yeah.
And I know that I remember that feeling when I got married when I was 29, thinking like, oh man, everything is exactly like it should be. And got the house and got the job and going to have the kids and do all the things. And then you just don't know. There's, you know, anybody who's listening to this, who's in their 50s or 60s, it's like, yeah, life comes with tragedy. Like life comes with pain. That is part of the deal. And yeah. So you're right. It's, you're young, man. Just wait. All the tragedy is still in your future.
Yeah. There are, as much as you, I might try to go through each day, not thinking about that sort of things. With each passing day, you know, you kind of have that realization that there are things that will begin to happen in my life that I haven't had to deal with a lot. And you see those things in your family and your network. And I've been lucky, fortunate to thus far to not have a lot of that. But again, I think, you know, you could speak to this, but I mean, that is part of life. It's a central theme of your book. There will be loss. There will be heartache, struggle, failure, all of it. We all experience that one way or another.
There's one scene in the book where it opens a chapter and there's a bunch of guys standing around some switchgrass in a little plot of CRP, like kind of a postage stamp of CRP in the middle of a cornfield. And I just, in the book, I just go around the circle and, you know, one guy is divorced and remarried and went through a lot of pain in that. Another guy is single and kind of hurting and lonely, and another guy is like fighting for custody of his kids, and another guy has had cancer twice, and another guy, then there's me who's been through my thing, and then there's my kid whose parents got divorced when he was 3, you know, and has been in therapy for years to deal with that what that means in his life. And I'm like, these are, you know, every one of us, we're these apex predators with guns in our hand trying to find some pheasants in switchgrass, but each one of us is a wounded, broken predator, you know, like we've all had our own suffering. And yeah, that's life. And that's frankly one of the things I like about hunting. As I write in the book a lot about, is that it reminds me of my own mortality, that I'm, you know, my life, my time here is finite, that I'm flesh and bone and blood and like these creatures I'm chasing and hunting and eating. I'm part of this whole, you know, I'm part of the whole mix with them. It's what it's really done, frankly, is it has disabused me of the dualism that I had grown up with in the Christian church, which is like, yeah, we're bodies, but I mean, what really matters is your soul, your immaterial soul. And it turns out that that's not really necessarily a Christian idea. That's more comes from Plato and Hellenistic philosophy. And in hunting, I think it breaks down that dualism. It's just like, no, we're this unified being of body and spirit, and you cannot separate the two. And we're just, yeah, like you use the word fragile. You know, frankly, we walk around like we're not, but we're just as fragile as one of those white-tailed deer or one of those walleyes or one of those pheasants that we're chasing.
Yeah, absolutely. for anybody that hasn't read the book, is interested in the book, I think that that is, it's very introspective in that way. You ask a lot of questions sort of yourself and of the reader. And I appreciated that. Again, it's a different addition to my library of outdoor related books, but I'm very glad it found its way onto my bookshelf. And it's, I think anybody that's been hunting a long time, maybe not anybody, but I know as I have done, I started when I was very young. So I started when I was 10 and I was kind of smiling, listening to, or reading a rereading a passage in your book where you're talking about, you know, when you're a kid, you know, you think nothing of pulling a bluegill out of the lake and, oh, the hook is buried down deep and I'll get the hook out and I'll throw it. And we were at my cabin a couple weekends ago and my kids have taken to fishing. My kids are 6 and 3 and I am like, as much as I used to catch bluegills and really not think twice about it, I'm like, I'm struggling right now. Like I'm taking all the barbs off the hooks of my kids' hooks. And just, if we don't get, we don't set the hook fast enough and a bluegill gets it buried, I'm just like, it's like affecting me in these weird ways. And I'm trying to like, I don't want to like diminish my kids' experience. Like I came to all these things over a long period of time, but it's this weird thing that we fed a bluegill to the eagle last week and it was kind of cool, I guess, because it happened right there in front of us. But there are many things like that in the outdoors and things that I continue to, new things that I question each year, and things affect me in a different way when I'm holding a dead grouse in my hand versus Nick holding that same dead grouse in his hand 20 years ago. It's just, I think we all think about those things.
Man, I love it. I love to hear that, Nick, honestly, because I think, I mean, at like a bigger, like 30,000 foot level, I think the future of hunting and fishing needs to be that, needs to be a lot more of those of us who are invested in that, in the kill and the mortality of the animal and the sacred connection that we have to those animals that we're killing and eating and we're taking into our own bodies and that we're serving to our families. I've many times disparaged the outdoors TV shows that are like guys growing big bucks on their food plots and then whisper, 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 bang, high fives, oh my God, and then the grip and grin, you know, shot. That I think is that's not what the hunt is about for me. The hunt is much more about a sacred connection with all these animals with whom we share the planet, and then also the truth that I eat. I'm a meat eater, and so I want to be involved in the meat that I'm eating, be it a white-tailed deer or, you know, a tiny little woodcock breast, you know. I want to respect that life. And so I think what you're experiencing, even like yanking a hook out of a bluegill, now that you have kids, that I think that's a pretty common experience, that it's becomes a bit more poignant. And I think as we age, we probably become more cognizant of our connection to those other critters. And we don't take that for granted. Especially when you have little kids and you realize the fragility of those little creatures and how your job is to try to, you know, I used to have a phrase, keep them alive till they're 5, because they're just like constantly trying to kill themselves doing, you know, stupid stuff or whatever. Yes, it's, I think that's a part of aging, and I think it's so important to be aware of it, like I say, be cognizant of it. And for those of us who hunt and fish, I think we can, if we're more, I mean, these seem like kind of like new agey type jargon or whatever, but if we can be more mindful of those lives that we're taking and consuming, it will make us, frankly, better stewards, better conservationists, better environmentalists. We'll care more about this planet that we co-inhabit with all these other critters.
Yeah. Yep. I certainly appreciate that. And it's, for me, it's just something that I'm like an observer of myself which is good in many ways. And I continue, like each year I continue to observe, sort of, I think back on how my love and my passion for grouse hunting specifically started and developed and like really propelled me into just this pursuit, endless pursuit of grouse. And that is still there. But then I have these other feelings about the grouse and how I go about my hunting. And I've found it very interesting just to kind of observe myself and how my thoughts and feelings change and evolve, I guess would be one way to put it. Cause I mean, my drive to hunt is still there. My love for the birds is no less, but I think about them in different, I think about things maybe deeper than I did when I was 10 years old, which I think is quite natural.
That's right. I think that's exactly right. And this is, you know, this book is not a book I could have written when I was 30. I wrote other kinds of books when I was 30. This was a book that took some more maturation, you know, the wine needed to sit in the bottle for a while and become a more complex bouquet for me to write. And it took me a long time. You know, I wrote this book, it took over 10 years. It's the shortest book I've ever written, and it took me 10 years, and I cut a lot out of it, and a lot of it changed over time. But I think same. I'm a few years ahead of you on that journey, but yeah, I'm thinking about things, I'm processing things, I'm engaging with the ideas of my own mortality in ways that I simply didn't as a younger man.
I did find that interesting. I wanted to ask you about that, 'cause I don't know that I would have known that, but I heard it as you were chatting with our mutual friend Mike Nadeski on his podcast, that it took you 10 years to write the book. I'm kind of curious, like, what was the, first of all, what was the inspiration or motive spark to write the book? And then, if at all, did that sort of change over that 10 years? Like, how did your idea and thoughts on the book change over that time period?
Yeah, well, it changed a lot. I mean, I looked back and I think I first pitched this idea to my literary agent like 12 years ago or something like that. And she was, you know, open to the idea. And so we kind of fiddled around with it a little bit. But it wasn't so much a memoir. It was more like how to find God in the wilderness, you know, this kind of thing. And so I just started writing. And then I kind of had a version of the book, and she took it out and tried to sell it unsuccessfully for about a year. And then she and I ended up going our own separate ways. I got a new literary agent, and he was like, let's take a different tack on this book. Like, let's go a different angle with it. And part of it was just because he's like, memoir, the market for memoir is real soft right now, and it's particularly soft for like memoirs by middle-aged white guys who live in Edina. That's not really a great hook for a book. You know what I mean? So he's like, well, let's try to organize it instead of, let's organize it thematically, you know? And so you've already mentioned some of the chapters. The book took on a very different shape. I was able to, you know, I kind of equate it to like, let's say you build a house on a lot and you build a rambler, and then you're like, this, I don't want to live in a rambler. I want to live in a two-story colonial. And so on the next lot over, you start building a colonial and you frame it up the house. You frame up the new house. And then you can go back to the old house and you can be like, well, I think I can still use this sheetrock, you know, and we'll use the same dining room table and stuff like that. So once I framed it up differently, and then I could go back to earlier versions of the manuscript and say, like, this story fits better in this chapter. This story doesn't fit at all in the book. So that was kind of the process of writing it. And it's a much better book as a result. And as I think also is in the acknowledgments somewhere in the book, but Mary Carr, who's just one of the great memoirists alive today, she said, you shouldn't write about anything till it's at least 8 years in the past. Mm-hmm. And so I think another part of it was just that a lot of the stuff I was writing about was too close. It was too recent, and I had to have more distance from it, frankly. I also had to, like, there were earlier iterations of the book that was like, I'm going to settle scores with my ex-wife. I'm going to air some dirty laundry. I'm going to prove to the reader that I was in the right and she was in the wrong. So I had to get all that. I had to exercise all that out of my system. And I had to, I mean, this is probably more relevant to your podcast, but I had to figure out how to write about the outdoors because, you know, you're an outdoors guy in the outdoors industry. I'm sure you read a ton of outdoors writing, and there's just, it's very hard to write, I think, about a hunt without being cliche. Hunts aren't that, one hunt isn't that different from the next. It just like one yellow lab isn't that different from the last yellow lab, even though every yellow lab's the greatest dog that ever, you know, it's the, I own the greatest dog. I just barely, you know, like how many, most outdoors magazines are like, do not, they'll even say on their website, like, do not send us a story pitch about your dead dog and how your dead dog is the greatest dog that's ever roamed the earth, because every guy thinks his dog is the greatest bird dog of all time. And so to write about my dogs without being cliche, to write about a duck hunt, to write about a pheasant hunt without being cliche, there's a writer I know whose writing I read a lot, and I'm like, okay, he's already said the word shotgun. I'm guessing in the next paragraph he calls it a scattergun. And then sure enough, next paragraph he calls it a scattergun. You know, it's hard. It's just, that's hard.
Yes.
So I had to work and work and work to have the outdoors, to have the, and this was a great compliment I got from an editor in New York who read the book at a big publishing house and didn't end up buying it, but he did write, the outdoors and hunting scenes are the most fully realized writing in the book. And so I was like, well, that's a great, that's a victory. That's a victory for me if I can, to this guy who's, I mean, I could explain it, but he's like the least hunting guy you could ever imagine. He's like New York editor, African-American gay guy. He's like, I've never even touched a gun before, but I loved your hunting scenes in the book. I'm like, okay, I'm making progress. You know, I'm learning how to write about hunting in ways. So it just, you know, it took a while. It took a while, and I think it's a better book because it took so long. It was at times frustrating. I'm like, is this book ever going to be done? But yeah, that's why. I think just so it would be better, I could be a better writer.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I appreciate that. And again, I said it before, you know, thought-provoking is the word that comes to mind. And I think we all would have experience, you know, how your thoughts and feelings about a certain thing or event or what change, or, you know, you go and revisit something. And if you journal or something, you journal, you really get a, which I'm not very good about. I try to be on certain things, especially with my kids. And I think about that, but to go back and reread like how you're thinking and feeling and how much that has changed just with a little bit of time. I think that was evident. I mean, there were some complex patterns of thought, and I would say, not just to blow smoke, but I would agree that the outdoor scenes and events in the books, they were not the kind of things that I was anticipating, like, oh, and we're gonna go over the next rise and there's gonna be a flush and a I mean, it wasn't about that, right, to be fair, but.
Yeah.
But I would, I think you did a good job if that's what you set out to do. They were not cliche, and they were different outdoor scenes and events and depictions than they were not predictable, if that makes sense.
Thanks. Well, I appreciate that. And I really immersed myself in great nature writing while I was writing this book. And, you know, I quote some of my writing heroes in the book, but whether it's, you know, Annie Dillard or Sigurd Olsen or Aldo Leopold or Jim Harrison, whom we quoted about the dogs. I mean, these are writers who went another layer or two deeper. They weren't just like, yeah, exactly. Like, oh, and then, yeah, we turned the next corner and wow, four pheasants got up and I shot and I missed and blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, they were more looking for the spiritual connections in the outdoors. So I would, a passage like that, I would write and rewrite and rewrite to try to get it as good as I could get it and try to get the reader to be there with me to experience what I was experiencing, not just at the, like, what it's like to shoot a bird and have a dog bring it back to you, but like what it does to you, what it does to me, like the impact it has in my soul, or the passage about, you know, shooting and wounding a deer, but walking up and having that deer still be alive. You know, it's like, yeah, you with the fish. It's just, it's a brutal, brutal experience. And it is an experience I never want to get numb to. I never want to get numb to the feelings that I'm killing another animal and what the panic in that animal's eyes when I cripple it instead of killing it. I want that feeling, that reality of what that means to me and what that means to my fellow creature I'm killing.
Well, it only seems to be getting more and more real to me. That's been one of my biggest observations over the last however many hunting seasons. But we're going to wrap up here shortly, but you mentioned a couple of writers there. I'm glad you brought that up because I wanted to ask you, I think there's some quotes and there are some other authors, if anybody is interested in kind of like these, you know, and it could be on the religious side of things. I think there's one author that you mentioned that you really like her stuff. But again, that thought provoking look at the outdoors and our relationship with nature. Anything else come to mind that you'd recommend?
Well, there's an epigraph in each chapter, like an opening quote, you know, from another author. And a lot of those, I would say, you know, whether it's John McPhee writing about canoes or whether it's Jim Harrison writing about hunting dogs, the Christian author, she's not really Christian. She's more of a spiritual author, Barbara Brown Taylor. She endorsed my book, and she has, there's a big long quote from her right before the very final chapter. And of course, like Sigurd Olsen, Aldo Leopold, John Muir, some of the giants, and Ralph Waldo Emerson, you know, there's a lot of different authors I quote, but there's just some really great outdoors writing. Edward Abbey is another one who comes to mind, but there's some really great outdoors writing out there for people who are into it. And I would encourage any of your listeners who to pursue that and not to get hung up with like, oh, I've read enough stories in enough outdoors magazines or the outdoor section of the newspaper. It all kind of starts to sound the same. I think if you dig a little deeper and find some of those truly great writers, you'll be pleasantly surprised at the kind of spiritual depths that they plumb as they're doing their writing. And that was the kind of writing I wanted to do. I don't know if I pulled it off, but that's what I was trying to do. And there's a great, frankly, it's funny because, you know, in the conservation outdoors industry area, I mean, in that sphere right now, there's kind of probably a little bit like, we don't do religion, you know, like we don't do politics, we don't do religion. That stuff's radioactive. We just talk about the outdoors. But the greatest writers in our tradition, like the Sigurd Olsen, who's probably more responsible than anybody for protecting the boundary waters. If you read his books, like deeply spiritual guy, writes openly about it. About God, uses the term God, you know. Aldo Leopold, John Muir, Jim Harrison, Buddhist guy, you know, Gary Snyder, Buddhist guy. These people they're writing about hunting and fishing and the outdoors and saving the outdoors, but they're also like deeply connected to their own spirituality and they're unafraid to write about it. So I hope, you know, I don't know. I don't know your listenership that well, but they might be like, why do you have a spiritual writer, former pastor on a podcast about bird hunting? What kind of gun does he shoot and what size shells does he use or whatever?
Is it even
we can talk about that, but yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's like, this is, I think, the future of conservation, frankly, is connecting to the meaning of life and the meaning of why we do this. And I just loved, frankly, I just love to hear that, that as now that you're a dad and as you're getting older, you're like thinking more about that your spiritual connection with that bluegill. I mean, that's beautiful. I think that's beautiful, and you should pay attention to that. And we all should pay attention to that. And it doesn't mean we like, oh, I'm going to become a vegetarian. No, it's like, this is what our ancestors did. I had Jim Shockey on my podcast, and just like, not only like a huge hunting TV rock star guy, but one of the most genuinely beautiful human beings I've ever spoken to. And he talked about feeding your ancestral soul. Like, why he hunts is it connects him to his ancestral soul. That is the very reasons his ancestors hunted. That's why he wants to hunt. And now we have to fight for it in the modern world, because it's a lot easier to go to Costco and buy super cheap meat than it is to go out and like load a gun and spend a day in the woods and try to, you know, hunt your own meat. But it does connect us to something that I think we're losing.
Yeah. Yeah. That's well said, man. It's the I cannot avoid the complexity of it. And I will continue to observe and pay attention to it, because it feels like the right thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah. It is the right thing to do.
We are days away from September 1st. I know you got a Boundary Waters trip coming up. This is a beautiful time of year to go to the Boundary Waters. That's going to be a blast. But what are you most looking forward to this fall from a hunting perspective?
Boy, that's so hard. I mean, my absolute crack cocaine is South Dakota pheasant hunting. I love it. It's just ideal. Late season South Dakota pheasant hunting is what I'm crazy about. I love pounding cattails that are covered with snow with a lab, and just like feeling sweat dripping down, you know, my back, even though it's 10 degrees outside with 15-mile-an-hour winds. I just love it. So that's probably, you know, some December, January pheasant hunt will be the peak experience. But yeah, I mean, starting on Sunday, I'll be early Canada goose. Bought my $4 tag, and I'm going to be out there trying to decrease the goose population. I don't do the early teal, because I did that a couple years ago and I shot a wood duck, you know, that was screaming by me. And I'm like, oh, that's a teal. Bam. And then the dog brings it back. I'm like, I just killed a wood duck hen. Like, that's terrible. So I'm against the early teal season. I think it's a bad idea, and so I don't participate in that. But early goose, and then I'll be out after grouse, and hope to do some duck hunting in North Dakota and Northeast Colorado, do some fly fishing in Southwest Colorado in late October, and then by the time I get back from that big trip, it'll be time for pheasants in South Dakota, and then that will be my all-consuming passion until the end of January, with probably a whitetail, whitetail hunt in there. How about you?
Cool. Yeah. Well, yeah. I am anticipating the ruffed grouse opener coming for us, which I get less excited about now than I did a long time ago because of the dogs and that's not the prime time of the season, which is obvious, but it would be an excuse to probably be at my cabin and have my boys, my older one is six, and he's walking along with me now, and so we can have fun with that and do that. But I will be making a Western trip for sharptails and hopefully some Hungarian partridge. I've grown to love that again with the dogs. And then, you know, I'm pretty, as much as I appreciate, you know, I love talking to upland hunters all across the country, and I really want to go and explore and experience things. I definitely take advantage of the opportunities I have here in my backyard. I mean, it's easy and it's convenient, and with the young kids and stuff, it allows me to be here at home. So I will take full advantage of the grouse hunting for as long as we can. And last year was like, for Nick's adventures, last year was like the exact opposite of like, we had no winter, as you know, and like the grouse hunting was phenomenal all the way until the end. So I felt little need to go anywhere and do anything. But I've got a couple ideas this year that I might branch out a little bit. But again, you give me an afternoon in the grouse woods and I'm a happy guy.
Beautiful. Well, yeah. If I'm heading up there to Ely to do a little grouse hunting in the Boundary Waters, maybe I'll swing by Duluth and you can jump in the truck and away we go.
Please do. Yeah. I want to keep in touch and I'm serious about the Boundary Waters thing. We'll have to talk about that next summer. I'm sure our paths will cross, but we could do a pheasant hunt, grouse hunt exchange and do something a little different. That'd be fun.
Sounds fun. Yeah, I'm down with that.
I thought there was one other thing I was going to ask you. Maybe not. No, we did the book recommendations.
Benelli Super Black Eagle 3 and
12 gauge.
You know, fed 12, always 12. I mean, I need to invest in a good 20 gauge for a grouse hunt, but I cannot miss with that Benelli. It's crazy to me. I've never owned a gun like that before where even when I'm shooting clays, it's just like I shoot 9 out of 10. I mean, and I'm not a great shot. It's something about that gun. It fits me perfectly. So anyway,
there is something to be said about having a gun that fits you and you are confident with.
Yeah.
And that is a good thing, Tony. So.
That's right. Yeah.
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 Well, thank you so much for coming on to the Birdshot Podcast and sharing a bit about yourself and the book. You have your own podcast. You have this book available, obviously, The God of Wild Places. Tell the listeners where to go to find it all.
Yeah, just go to godofwildplaces.com, and that'll take you to my website. You can find out, you not only can buy the book through whatever online retailer, you can buy a copy from me that I'll sign and send to you. And then you can find my podcast and all my social media and everything there. So yeah, godofwildplaces.com.
Wonderful. I will link it all in the show notes. And once again, Tony,
thanks.
Thank you for your time today. I appreciate it. I wish you the best of luck this season. Have a great one, and we'll be in touch, my friend.
Same to you, Nick. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, and share. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast.